Welcome to the Medical Journal of Australia podcast. The MJA is Australia's top peer-reviewed general medical journal, publishing groundbreaking research to the medical community since 1914. My name is Kate Swanell, and I am the MJA's news and online editor. Every 2 years since the summer of 2013-2014, infectious disease specialists have been treating increasing numbers of infants suffering from parechovirus infections. Parechovirus genotype 3 has been associated with more serious disease and is recognised as a serious cause of sepsis-like illness and central nervous system infections. Dr. Philip Britton is a paediatric infectious diseases physician at the Children's Hospital at Westmead, and he's also a senior lecturer in child and adolescent health at the University of Sydney. He and his co-authors have written a narrative review of parechovirus, which you can find at www.mja.com.au. Dr. Britton is my special guest on the pod today. What is parechovirus and why are we worried about it right now?
So parechovirus is a cousin virus of the better known enteroviruses, which are the causes of hand, foot and mouth disease, which is a common childhood illness in the community. And the parechoviruses were originally part of that group of enteroviruses, but were renamed as a separate group of viruses in the 1990s. And they've become important in Australia since 2013. Before that time, there was no real evidence that parechoviruses were causing significant illness in children. But in 2013, there was a large outbreak of one particular type of parechovirus, and that type is genotype 3, in New South Wales, and then waves of that epidemic progressed across Australia. And why it came to attention was because children were being admitted to hospital with really severe illness requiring intensive care management and causing a lot of stress for clinicians because of how unwell these children were. And at that time, the parechovirus was isolated from these children, and it was really a novel experience for clinicians in New South Wales and nationally, and was really practice changing from their point of view in terms of the first time they'd come across this infection. Now, that epidemic in 2013-2014 waned, and it was unclear exactly what was going to happen, but what we do know now is that two subsequent epidemics have occurred in 2015-16 and now most recently in 2017-18 over the spring-summer period, again causing really large numbers of children to be admitted to hospital with severe illness.
So it's happening every couple of years?
That's what we've observed here in Australia, and strikingly, a very similar pattern's been observed in the UK with parechovirus as well. So,
also over their summer?
Yes.
Okay.
So, and the two-yearly pattern in the UK and here has not been so clearly observed in other locations like Europe and North America, and we don't have a strong rationale for why it happens in this two-yearly cycle at the moment. But the similarity with the UK is striking, and striking enough that we would anticipate that we'll see future epidemics of this.
How does it present?
Most often, the parechoviruses cause mild illness
right.
in children and adults. A bit of a gastroenteritis or a cold flu-like illness. And so in most people, it's really what you would call a relatively benign infection. But in very young children, so that's children under 6 months, particularly under 3 months of age, that's the group that it can present as if they've got bacterial sepsis, is one way it presents. And equally, it can also present with central nervous system infection, meningitis, and involvement of the brain. And that's the word for that's encephalitis.
So that must be confusing is probably the wrong word, but there's a whole bunch of differential diagnoses showing up there that make it difficult to pin down that it's pareco, presumably.
That's exactly right. So these children essentially present very unwell, looking like they could have a bacterial infection, looking like they could have bacterial meningitis, occasionally looking like they could have encephalitis with fitting or loss of consciousness. And acutely, a whole range of things, and the acute response is often management for sepsis, intensive care. Occasionally, these children are shocked and require blood pressure support and things
right.
like that in intensive care. And the only way to know that it's parechovirus is really to test for that virus. And so part of the reason to kind of communicate this more widely is that this is a relatively new thing in Australia, only since 2013. The only way to know it's parvovirus is to do a specific test for it.
Yep.
It's not going to be picked up by other kinds of testing. And clinicians really need to think of it as one of the potential infectious causes of this spectrum of presentations.
I'm guessing that this isn't something that's going to show up in primary care, that these kids are sick enough that they're going to go straight to the emergency rooms?
As far as we can tell, based on the epidemiology of Australia, the testing is most important for hospital clinicians to
right.
be aware of.
Yeah.
It's not really something that, you know, we need GPs or other primary care practitioners to test people with colds and gastro. There may be a role for doing that in epidemics into the future. We haven't really kind of resolved that issue. But as in terms of routine clinical care, it's not really an issue in primary care. But one of the things that I think primary care and community practitioners need to be aware of is that there is a potential for adults and older children or older siblings to transmit this virus to little babies,
right.
and it might be the baby that gets sick. So that just emphasises all of those messages about hand hygiene and good infection control in the home when you've got very young children around.
Is this a bug that lives on us all the time? Do we all have it?
No. So as far as we're aware, this is not a colonizer of people. So if you get infected, you some people will have very mild illness, the majority probably. Some will get sick, but you do clear the virus. It doesn't stay in the body.
Is this a case of this actually happening more often, or are we detecting it more often and better?
Yeah, so that when the first epidemic occurred, that was a genuine question that we had. Have we just not recognised this in the past? But in fact, we've gone some way to answering that, I think. Colleagues at Deakin University in Geelong have now taken virus from that first epidemic and fully sequenced it to understand its genetic makeup. And it appears that virus that appeared in 2013 in Australia was a novel version of this parvovirus type 3.
Mm.
It was what's called a recombinant. So two viruses had come together and switched their genetic material and formed a new sort of hybrid virus. And that kind of squares well with our observation that clinicians said we haven't seen something like this before in Australia. And it's very likely that this virus was introduced from outside of Australia.
Okay.
Maybe it then reassorted in Australia. It's hard to know whether that happened in Australia or overseas, but it was a new virus to this country.
Are kids dying from this?
At this point in time in Australia, we have not recorded deaths, as far as we're aware.
Mm. Have there been some pretty adverse outcomes, though?
Yes, and it is fair to say that children have died from this parvovirus. There's been reports of deaths from parvovirus in other parts of the world. So
right.
it's not, you know, but deaths are not common at all.
Yeah.
However, if you get the brain infection, the encephalitis from this parvovirus, we've been involved in research following up children who had that complication from the 2013 epidemic, and we've shown that a high proportion of those kids go on to have complications, neurological complications, be that cerebral palsy, visual loss, learning difficulties, behavioural problems.
Should this be a notifiable disease, do you think?
Yeah, so I think it's fair to say that's an active consideration.
Mm.
Australia has a very robust notifiable disease surveillance system, and it has a very robust process that's required to go through in order to get onto that system because, you know, it requires legislation, it's costly and demanding on this. I think it's an active consideration. We have certainly approached the Commonwealth Department of Health about considering it. There are some reasons why it would be a good candidate. There are reasons why it wouldn't be a good candidate to be on the notifiable disease surveillance system. And I think I'm very confident that the right process is being undertaken to consider that at this very time.
Because apart from anything else, it would be good to know where it's appearing and how often. And
many active questions in terms of how has this virus come here? Is it evolving since it's been in Australia? Are we right to expect future epidemics? I mean, we have the observation of what's happened in the past, but will they attenuate over time or will they get worse over time? All of those things are unresolved questions.
Is this bug picking out particular ethnicities or travellers or
No, so as far as we can tell, there's no particular ethnic predisposition. We do know quite a lot about enteroviruses and how they are transmitted in the community, and as I said, this is a sort of cousin of that. And it's very likely that this virus infects many, many children in the community when it comes through in a wave, and only a fraction of them are getting very unwell from it. And that's one of the complications in terms of making it notifiable, is we don't have a sense of what fraction get very sick, how many children get this infection and actually have no symptoms, and what does that result in? Do they develop immunity that's long-lasting, for example?
If they develop immunity, does that mean there's a possibility of a vaccine?
Yeah, so that's one of the reasons we'd like to understand that issue of what is the host immune response to, you know, in people who get infected with this virus. Because if they develop specific immunity, and that immunity is what we call neutralizing, it can actually stop the virus, that really does raise the possibility of developing a vaccine. And we know you can develop vaccines for specific enteroviruses. The poliovirus is a type of enterovirus, and it's been a very successful campaign to eradicate that. Not quite done yet, but almost there. And another enterovirus that is causing a lot of problems in Asia at the moment, enterovirus 71, there's been a big effort to develop a vaccine for that in China, and an effective vaccine has been developed. One of the things that's hampered vaccine development for enteroviruses in the past is there are many, many subtypes, and they come in different waves and overlap with each other. So there isn't one catch-all vaccine. But I guess where we have a particular subgroup or subtype of these viruses causing severe problems, we at least know that there is a theoretical pathway to developing a vaccine. But what we need to know is that the host immune response is neutralising and effective first.
Is there a danger this will do what influenza does and mutate every year or change its form every year?
Yeah, that's a concern as well. These parainfluenza are RNA viruses, and like influenza, RNA viruses are much more prone to genetic mutation. And we know that these enteroviruses and parainfluenza can recombine. That's what we've observed with this new virus in Australia. So we've actually actively involved in a research process at the moment where we're going to try to take viruses from the three sequential pandemics and compare them to try to understand how is it evolving genetically in Australia over the last 5-6 years. And how does that match with the clinical presentation of the illness? And that will help us answer some of those questions in terms of the risk of it mutating, getting worse, changing, etc.
In the meantime, what can clinicians do?
So I think the key at this point in time is to be aware of this virus, be aware that it can cause severe disease in young children, and consider it as one of the potential causes of severe neurological and septic infection in young babies. In those babies who get infected and are hospitalised, to be aware that some of them can develop complications, and not just acute complications, but long-term complications. So to be doing the kinds of things that may be necessary to assess for that, both acutely and follow-up. One of the things that we've been really advocating for is that in the most sick of those babies, when they're admitted to hospital, those who end up in intensive care or those who do have neurological manifestations, we think that they should be imaged with an MRI up front, because some of our data shows that if you have an abnormal MRI, that's predictive of having problems down the track. And if you have a normal MRI, we'd be much more reassured about the long-term outcome in those kids. Now, the data that we have on that is not definitive at this point in time, but we think it's pretty robust. And we want clinicians to be thinking about complications early, assessing for them, but also following kids up closely. Because one of the challenges with infections that happen in very young children is they can appear to recover, but their brain function has not developed to the extent that some of the deficits they might have would manifest. So things like learning, for example, they're not going to show up until you hit school. Complex motor functions aren't going to show up until you're 2, 3, 4. And these babies are being discharged from hospital when they're 2 or 3 months of age.
Yes.
And so we just want to raise the awareness in the community and amongst clinicians about the potential complications.
So follow up over years,
critical,
presumably.
It's critical, we think.
Yeah.
So one of the things that we've been advocating for on the public health side and on the research side is that we need to keep a monitor on this disease in Australia. And that's obviously going to require funding and public health commitment. And so, you know, I'm confident that that's been considered actively in the public health sphere. And we know that there's been some research funding released by different research groups over the last couple of years. I guess we're advocating that that continue.
Yes.
And we're also, you know, very keen for clinicians out there who have concerns about acute cases to be in contact with their infectious disease service in their state and jurisdiction. The paediatric infectious disease community around Australia has become, you know, very aware of this virus, and there's a lot of active research going on. And we'd love people to, both clinicians and patients, to be able to engage in that process. We encourage that, and we don't want clinicians out there to feel that there aren't people they can consult on specific children in real time if necessary. That's brilliant. Thanks very much, Kat.
Thanks a lot for your time, Phil. My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.